Good morning. Can I ask you to please take your seats? I'm President Futter from Barnard, and I'd like to welcome you to Barnard College and to the 11th, the Scholar and the Feminist Conference. The Scholar and the Feminist is sponsored by Barnard's Women's Center. The Women's Center was founded in 1971 and serves as a vital link between the college and the community of scholars and feminists working for the advancement of women in society. In addition, the Women's Center houses an outstanding research library on women's issues. In sponsoring this conference each year, the Women's Center provides a forum for feminist scholarship and addresses issues that affect women's progress and society's perception of women. The theme of this year's conference is a particularly interesting one, women and resistance. It is a subject of vital importance to anyone who is concerned with issues of human rights and social justice. Today's conference will be opened by a speaker who is well known to everyone here. Bella Abzug hardly needs an introduction, but I would like to share with you some of the highlights of her absolutely remarkable career. A graduate of Hunter College, Bella Abzug received her law degree from Columbia University in 1945. She served in Congress as representative from New York's 19th and 20th congressional districts. From 1961 to 1970, she served as legal director of Women's Strike for Peace. During the International Women's Year in 1977, she was the presiding officer of the National Committee on the Observance of International Women's Year and presided at the National Women's Conference in Houston. In 1978, she co-chaired the President's National Advisory Committee for Women. Bella Abzug is a member of Women's Strike for Peace, the National Women's Political Caucus, the National Urban League, the National Organization for Women, the United Nations Association of the United States, and is Vice President of Americans for Democratic Action. In 1977, Bella Abzug founded Women USA, a non-member organization which serves as an information and action network on women's issues and serves as the organization's president today. It is a very great pleasure indeed for me to welcome Bella Abzug to Barnard and to introduce her to you now as our opening speaker, Bella Abzug.
Thank you very much. I am very honored to be asked to speak at such a formidable conference called Women and Resistance, because after all, resistance is tough word, and I suppose we need more of it. I just was in California, and I saw a very interesting bumper sticker, which I suppose maybe some of you have seen, but I haven't. And it sort of startled me, because it said, "Women who seek equality with men lack ambition." Well, anyhow, I've been thinking about our born-again women's movement, which started in the late 60s and the 70s, and in connection with what I feel is an enormous response and resistance of women to Reaganism, to Reaganomics, to the oppression of people who are outside of the political power structure, namely minorities and women, young people and the elderly people, Mim Kelber and I, whom many of you know, decided that we had been doing a lot of work on the gender gap and that we would put it into a book and so that we'd be able to use it to mobilize people in this election year to conduct one kind of important resistance. And the reason that we decided to do this was that as we examined every aspect of American life and we looked backwards and forwards and observed that women had unleashed an explosion of needs and self-discovery and new insights into personal and social relationships, which had put an enormous pressure on society and its institutions, and yet there was a failure to respond to the needs that we had. That though we recognized that what we required on the legal front was, for example, the repeal of thousands of old repressive laws and passage of new laws and programs, wrapping it all up in the adoption of the Equal Rights Amendment to give women a constitutional right of equality, we noticed that those who controlled power resisted our demand for the Equal Rights Amendment, though it was won in the hearts and minds of the American people. It was resisted by those at the top of the economic ladder and in those, in my opinion, at the top of the political ladder, whose benefit it is to maintain the status quo and to resist the demand that women have to change the nature of the power structure, to change the nature of the economic structure so that it can absorb the demands of a majority of the people who have largely been used by the power structure to take care of its needs, namely the power structures, rather than that of women. And so we came to understand that there had to be something said about why there was a response on the part of women, which was a little different than the response that had been before. The working mother who needed quality childcare for her preschoolers and income tax deductions for childcare and household services, the middle-class housewife who had stifled her own abilities and ambitions to wait on her husband, needed educational opportunities to start her own career. The poor woman who had to go on welfare to support her children also needed low-cost or free childcare centers and job training as her escape route to self-respect and independence. And the young woman who had suffered the painful indignity of a back alley abortion, as well as the Native American woman on a reservation and the black woman in a slum who had been forcibly sterilized, wanted the removal of laws that prevented them from choosing when and if to have a child. The minority woman at the bottom of the economic ladder, the underpaid factory worker drudging away at a dead-end job, and the junior executive or college instructor who had been passed over for a deserved promotion that went to a less qualified male colleague, wanted affirmative action programs and other legal remedies against job and pay discrimination. The student who in the old days had to choose between being a secretary, nurse, or teacher, wanted the legal opportunity to become an electrician, truck driver, engineer, doctor, lawyer, or astronaut. And the aging woman whose husband had divorced her for a younger woman wanted guaranteed Social Security in her own name, and the struggling businesswoman wanted access to credit and loans. The victim of wife beating wanted a place where she and her children could take shelter. The lesbian wanted the repeal of laws that threatened her with arrest for her private sexual preferences and an end to discriminatory practices that threatened her with loss of job, apartment, or child custody. The rape woman wanted the right to a trial of her assailant in which she was not made to feel like a criminal, and the loyal political volunteer who had always helped elect men to office felt it was time to get herself and other women elected to positions of power and responsibility. Well, what has been the reaction of the male power structure to all of these demands, which are the growing process of where women are in society today? Over and over, I have seen our government leaders and political parties obstruct and operate in ways contrary to what people want. Added to our rejection of our needs and our concerns was also a manipulation of the power structure to continue to oppress not only women but men in this country, overflowing boundaries to other countries. President Lyndon Johnson, elected in 64 on a pledge of no wider war, escalating the war in Indochina to horrendous dimensions. Chicago Mayor Richard Daley's police viciously beating up thousands of or hundreds of men, women, and young people trying to make the 68th Democratic Party convention respond to their peace demands against the war in Vietnam. President Nixon ordering the secret bombing of Cambodia and covering up his Watergate scandal. President Ford issuing the unpardonable pardon to Mr. Nixon. President Jimmy Carter backing out on his commitments to women and arms reductions. The Republican Party abandoning its historic support for the ERA. President Reagan giving still more to the rich taking from women, children, and the poor, and declaring that he was prepared to send U.S. troops anywhere on this earth, and members of Congress cravingly going along with the big budget slashes in necessary social programs, male-controlled state legislatures blocking debate and votes on the ERA. And so the response, the resistance to this description of where we are has been, in my opinion, ironically, the failure of our system to acknowledge the legitimate aspirations of women and minorities is resulting in a renewed commitment to a struggle of resistance, in a new renewed commitment to the struggle for equality and economic justice. There is today a very interesting development in which the vast majority of Americans are pointing dramatically to the need for new political leadership. In my judgment, its directions will not emerge without the involvement and the ideas and the leadership of women and minorities whose suppression obstructs America's further development into a thinking, caring society capable of living in peace and pursuing economic justice. I think that this is the explanation, in a certain way, of the phenomenon that has come to be called the gender gap. Oh, we've come a long way since the 19th century, in which they thought our brains were smaller and therefore we had to use all of our efforts and energies and our bloodstream for the purpose of childbearing and couldn't be diverted in any other way. Finally, we did get the vote and we did accomplish some interesting things, but essentially it was never thought that there was something independent, individual, or special, or even just human about the way in which women felt and the way women responded to issues. So the gender gap, which was first observed, I think, critically or analytically in the 1980 elections, when 8% fewer women voted for Mr. Reagan than men did, was actually a response of women across the board, the women that I mentioned in my description and those that I may not have mentioned, the working woman, the homemaker, the young, the old, the women of different backgrounds, of different ethnicity, religions, and races, of different sexual preference. Women were saying and looking at society and saying, well, I've asked you, I've negotiated with you, I've picketed you, I have voted for you, I have pleaded with you, I have compromised with you, I have negotiated with you, I've even prayed, and nothing has responded. And so I am now saying to you, for the first time in the history of this country, a majority of women are saying that we are at odds with almost every single policy of government which excludes us, which discriminates against us, which annihilates us, and ultimately is going to result in destroying not only us, but the total part of humanity of which we are a part. The gender gap, in my opinion, rests on many different things. It was said in 1980, by the way, where 6 million more women voted than men for the first time, that women voted less for Mr. Reagan because of his opposition to the ERA and because they thought he was trigger happy and would get us into war. In 1982, it was said that when women chose candidates based upon a series of gender gap issues, which include war, peace issues, equality, economic justice, environment, and so on, that it was because they were distressed with the economic status of the country at that time. Whatever it is, the gender gap showed itself then to be very strong in the election of any number of candidates, including 3 governors, Michigan, Texas, and our own governor, because those men took positions in their campaigns which were supportive of women's economic, social, cultural, and political needs. It has been said that this is just something which people are doing because they don't like Mr. Reagan. Of course they don't like Mr. Reagan, and women especially don't like Mr. Reagan. They're more disapproving of his foreign policy and his economic policies, his attack upon affirmative action, his attack upon ERA, his attack upon abortion than men are, because they are directly affected. People are asking me over and over, how come? I say, how come? And I reel out the series of events that you and I have been participating in for many years and have shown that the power structure has stubbornly, for selfish and good reasons, insisted on maintaining the status quo in the face of what is almost a revolutionary change in the condition of the lives of women and the lives of men and women affected by it on this particular, in this country. And so, at the moment, the Democratic Party, and this is something you should know because I know among you are many who are not particularly interested in participating in the party politics as we know it in this country, but at the moment, the Democratic Party happens to be the beneficiary of the gender gap votes. More women are taking on the Democratic Party because they believe that through that vehicle, women and minorities in particular can at least have the accomplishment of some of their policies effectuated, or at least can halt the repression against them that is so steadfast and consistent under this present administration with the unfortunate bipartisan concurrence of many people in the Congress of the United States. But it doesn't belong to the Democratic Party, the gender gap. It merely deals with the fact that at this moment, the women's vote, which is a thoughtful one and reflects the values of what many of us in the women's movement have sought to bring into the American landscape, it's largely based on what the candidate's position is on important policy matters. So if you're a Democrat and you're a big military spender or a war hawk and you favor cutting domestic programs such as job training or equal employment opportunities or family planning or social security or pollution control or oppose the ERA or the right to reproductive freedom, obviously you will not be the beneficiary of that vote. And so while everybody is pondering the meaning and the long-term meaning of the newly emerging electoral gap, those of us who are concerned in this with the struggles each day recognize that we have several gender gaps, not only the way women are demonstrating their behavioral and political attitudes through their vote and opinion polls, but we have a gender gap which is very deep in the power structure of this country. Though women are a majority of the population, we still hold only a small percentage of elective and appointive offices. We have 22 out of 435 women in the House, 2 out of 100 in the Senate. In fact, in the history of this nation, of 10,957 people who have served in the Congress of the United States, only 116 of them have been women. This is an interesting thing because I feel that it's quite interesting to me that all of us, including people in the women's movement and minority movements in this country, particularly those who have not had power, have not always been convinced that the way in which we could create change would be through actually securing representation in the power structure itself. I think that the candidacy of Jesse Jackson reflects something of a change in that direction and in the minds of many other people, because we are essentially, with that candidacy, on the eve of an electoral rebellion. That is a statement that the presidency of this country can no longer be considered anymore the sole white male American preserve that it has been to date. The fact that we are considering seriously the ways in which we can involve a woman as vice president indicates that the presidency and the vice presidency, or the question of the power structure and who governs in it, can no longer be considered the white male preserve it has been until now. And I think that's important for all of us in the movement for change, all of us in the peace movement, all of us in the civil rights movement, all of us in the movement of women in this country, all of those in the movement of justice in this country. Because I believe that the women's vote, though it is in the minds of many a very reformist manner and method of attacking our deep problems, is nevertheless a method that is essential at this time in order to oust from public office the most serious ideological Neanderthal this country has ever placed in the presidency. And so, as long as we shun the political power structure and say it's not ours, it belongs to the patriarchy, then we are remiss because it is our responsibility to reform the political power structure, if necessary, to take over the political power structure, to make it reflect the will of the majority of the Americans in this country. And only by participating in that struggle can we add the necessary dimension, it seems to me, to the processes that all of us are involved in, whether it's our educational process as academics or whether it's our activist process as activists. We have to also become political activists that are prepared to challenge the structure from outside as well as from inside. As one who has worked in both places, as one who came into the power structure and into the establishment from the movements of change, from the peace movement, from the civil rights movement, as well as from the feminist movement, I can tell you that the placement of women into the political power structure, the placement of minorities into the political power structure, is a very important path to empowerment, which we can no longer afford to ignore. And we must become part and parcel of that mighty effort to register as many votes as we can of the disenfranchised, to register as many votes as we can of the alienated, to get the issues before all of these people, to deal with the fact that the issues that they concern themselves with cannot be changed unless we have some power in the power structure, as well as power from the outside, to continue to mold and seek a new form of political process and a new form of political structure that will make a fundamental difference in our lives. And therefore, we have to become part of that struggle in 1984, because 1984 may well become a watershed year for American women and minorities in this country. I think it's important to recognize that when we're confronting an administration that during its period of time has seen 5 million more people sink into poverty, has seen a condition in which 20% of the children now live in households with incomes below 125% of the poverty level, then we have to begin to take charge. What is the gender gap? The gender gap is American women saying, I didn't make any of these policies. I didn't make the arms race. I didn't create this blasted, bloated military budget. I don't approve of cutting the social programs. I don't have the power and the power structure to make those policies, but I have the power to use a very fundamental right, which I'm now going to use because I believe I am sovereign. I have the sovereign power, and that is to use my vote to change those policies that I absolutely reject and that don't suit me, don't suit my friends, don't suit my family, don't suit my parents, and in our opinion, don't suit all of America. Women are a majority of Americans, and for the first time in history, they are odds with their government on almost every important issue of foreign and domestic policy. Through the phenomenon of the gender gap, American women are telling our male rulers that they're making the wrong choices. It's a message meant not only for the present occupants of the White House and the Congress, but for both major parties, and for those who hope to lead this nation in the years to come. I said before 1984 could be a watershed year in American political history because I think it marks the first time that women, through their voting power and their numbers and their organized strength, well, may not have a president who is a woman in the White House, but women could well decide who will be the next president of the United States, which party will control the Congress, who will reside in the governor's mansions across this nation, and who will serve in our state legislatures, and who will fill thousands of elective posts at the town, city, county, and state levels. I think that whether or not the gender gap is identified as a pro-ERA or a pro-peace vote, or whether it's regarded as a vote by professional working women, mostly over age 30, or a vote by single, divorced, poor, and minority women, an economic self-interest vote, or a vulnerability vote by women who perceive themselves as disadvantaged, or vulnerable minorities, like dependent on the goodwill of the male power structure. No matter what the theory is, no one theory, in my opinion, explains the gender gap phenomenon, because American women are a diverse group. And certain factors may have more influence on some than on others. Compassion, a yearning for peace, concern about the environment, the desire for economic security and equality are shared by most women. But the degree to which a particular factor motivates a particular woman or group of women may vary. And so I believe that women will be voting in coalition with other powerful anti-Reagan forces, environmentalists, blacks, Hispanics, other minorities, union members, working people, the poor and unemployed, gay and lesbians, young people who feel alienated in many ways today, business people, small business people who have lost their business through the high interest rates, farmers whose farms have been foreclosed for the same reasons, can expect to give a majority of their votes to the Democratic presidential candidate. Many of these constituencies overlap, and women appear in all of them. But I believe that in 1984, there will be at least 9 million more women voting than men. And I believe that those numbers are very crucial. It's true that 1 out of 3 eligible women did not bother to register in 1980. And that adds up to 27.3 million women who threw away a once-in-a-4-year opportunity to have a voice in running this country. Some 55.7 million did register, but 6.4 million of them did not follow up by actual voting. According to the Census Bureau, 49.3 million voted, but 33.7 million did not. The same thing exists with respect to minorities in this country. We have already seen an enormous increase in the votes of minorities in the primaries. The turnout, for example, in New York increased by 103% among minorities, among the blacks in this state. As I travel across the country, promoting my book, of course, but also using it as an opportunity to mobilize and organize people to get involved, to register, to vote, to mobilize, to project the major issues of our deep concerns, I find that there is a greater enthusiasm among young people, especially, who for a long time, despite the fact that we fought very hard to get the right to vote for the 18-year-olds as against the 21-year-olds, because we didn't think that a Congress had a right to send them to war without their having a right to participate in that decision, are becoming aware, are becoming concerned, are becoming a little bit more aggravated over the possibility of, once again, their self-interest becoming involved. The mining of the harbors in Nicaragua, the withdrawal of the jurisdiction of the World Court from the United States has shook up a lot of people in this country, not only the people like you and me, but the people in the power structure who until now have been spineless, have been lacking courage, have gone along with both economic and foreign policy issues supported and run by Mr. Reagan, which are destined to dislocate the future in this country and the future of the world. Finally, the response in the Congress itself, by the way, not with a lot of outside pressure, I may add. And I question and ask those people who are still very cynical about the political power structure and the process of sovereign voting and so on. Well, where is the major demonstration? Where is the major pressure being put upon the power structure to resist the callous unconcern and the ideological backwardness of President Reagan? Well, I was surprised to find that I got an immediate response from the Senate floor, because that has never happened so fast before in the history of this administration. The fact that there is a bipartisan resistance to the policies of Mr. Reagan, which are out of hand, should encourage those of us who are somewhat ahead of where I hope the Senate and the House of Representatives are, to make it our responsibility to see to it that the next steps are taken, that we are demanding of the Congress, of the Senate and the House, that they withdraw all military support from the energies that are being directed against the people's struggle for self-determination and the people's struggle for poverty and justice in Central America. And let me tell you something interesting. As a person who has been with many of you in the movements for change as well as in the power structure, there is no time like a time of choosing a president at the time of electing a Congress and state legislatures to be able to project the issues that you care about. This is the best time to come out of the classrooms, those of you who are academics, and get into the streets with the leaflets, and get into the supermarkets, and get into the city halls and the state houses and the Congress of the United States, and begin projecting the issues that we want to see represented in this country, where every institution is supposed to belong to the people of the United States, not to those who control the power structure, who do it to some extent with our support, by our withdrawal, by our abdication. And this is the time when we have to come forward, use the process in whichever way we can get ourselves to. If you can get yourself to register and vote, fine. If you can't do that, at least join the troops that are educating those to move in that direction so that we can really get something done. I plead with you because you know as well as I that the nuclear clock is ticking away. You know as well as I that the doomsday can take place unless we stop those who are at the top of the power structure from going so far to satisfy their own gregariousness, their own greed, that they are prepared to sacrifice and destroy this planet if necessary. We have got to stop that, and we can stop that by showing that we are unified in our demand to end the nuclear arms race. A nuclear freeze, yes, but more than that, negotiations with the Soviet Union to create the kind of nuclear arms reductions, and finally, general and complete disarmament so that we can settle disputes on this earth. So that we can settle disputes on this earth as civilized human beings instead of as war machines. That all superpowers have got to recognize that what is at stake is we the people, and we the people demand a right to live and love because we love life, and that's why we want it. Reagan would not have been elected if one out of every 20 people who voted for him stayed home. He would have lost if just 881,743 voters in 16 states had decided to cast their ballots for Carter instead. A tough choice, I know. But it was a choice. It was a choice. Even I, who got fired by him, voted for him because I know what the difference was. Just the other day, when we were discussing this thing, Martin said, Martin, my husband, said, I still can't get over the fact, Bella, that you got fired from a non-paying job. But the fact is, that if just 1% of all those who voted nationally switched, requiring a switch of only 4,666 votes in each of the congressional districts in those 16 key states, we would have had a different president. Now, it's very true that in some cases people feel that the differences are not that major. I happen to believe in this case the differences would have been quite major. We are being confronted, as you all know, by this social Darwinist who is pushing us back into the 19th century when we're struggling in the 20th to get into the 21st. We are being confronted with a president who, from the White House, is using this as a pulpit to destroy some of the fundamentals of democracy under which we survive, namely pluralism, diversity, separation of church and state. A man who, after the first day after the State of the Union address, went to talk to the electronic preachers to preserve the constitutional rights of the unborn as he was daily striking down the constitutional rights of the born, as he was daily attacking the rights of human beings to participate in the vast resources of this nation, which is the richest nation on this world, in this world. Of course, there's an anomaly to all of this, which is pretty shocking, that they're fighting for a constitutional amendment to declare the unborn fetus persons, and they're raising a very serious conflict of laws by this issue. What's going to happen if they should win this amendment for a constitutional right to declare the fetus unborn? And then when you become born and you happen to be a little girl, you no longer become a person, because we're not yet persons under the Constitution. So I just wanted to say here that the Democrats would have won if more women and blacks and Hispanics had voted in key states. Those of us who are involved in these movements have to understand what that means. Reagan's plurality in the 10 largest states was less than the number of all non-voting white women in each of those states, and less than the number of non-voting black men and women in Michigan, New York, and California, and less than the number of non-voting Hispanic women and men in California, New York, and Texas. This is an important message. It's an important message not only because of a 1984 presidential election, but it's an important message to bring our message forth. If we could make that much difference, and we are talking about 1.5 million registration, or 1.7 million of more women, and about 1 million more blacks in this country, and about 500,000 more Hispanics, in order to make sure that we can determine the defeat of Mr. Reagan. And that's why, if we want to project essentially what our differences are, what our issues are, that we have got to get involved in this fight. And various ways in which to do it, I'm not going to have the time to do here today. But you know what the coalition is. You know there are many different groups working on registration in this state, in this city. There's the usual organizations, plus additional ones like Human Serve, like Women USA, like a statewide coalition. Of course, the black and Hispanic groups that have been working consistently. And there's a way in which all can be involved in that. In fact, the way we analyze it in our book, Mim and I, you have to read the book in order to get the details. So. But anyhow, we got some here, you know. But anyhow, we figure that we're going to beat Mr. Reagan. We have a chapter on that in our book called Power at the Polls. And that this whole coalition will be responsible for it. But basically, he will be defeated with a gender gap, which women provide, as they are beginning to provide. Now, I know very well that the United States throughout its history has been marked by conflict between classes and social groups. between male rule and female subordination, between those who would reserve power only for a moneyed elite and those who say democracy must be shared by all of the people. Today, those of us who place humane, predominantly feminist values and democratic rights in the foreground are being attacked by Reagan Republicans for offering what they ridicule as old ideas. In fact, even some of our Democrats, even one running for president, sometimes suggest that. But eating every day, having work, shelter, clothing, education, and health care are ideas that will never go out of style. No matter how much the heads of corporations hope that robots will replace human beings and that women and minorities will meekly continue to accept inferior status and lower wages. And so I'm suggesting to you that both parties require our participation. I have not come here to make a partisan speech. I came here to make a nonpartisan speech to defeat Mr. Reagan, because I happen to believe that it's Reagan Republicanism that both Republicans and Democrats and independents and socialists and people of all points of view have an enormous responsibility to fight against. Our resistance must be upon the continuation of that kind of administration which reflects power for those who are the corporate military controllers of our society. $305 billion military budget, $200 billion deficit, $750 billion given to the rich, withdrawn from the Treasury in the Reagan tax program, so that when you earn a salary of over $10,000 a year, you have paid for Reaganomics by getting minus $320 in your salary each year. Or if you've earned over $80,000, then you will get at least $9,000 out of the taxpayers' buck in this country. That kind of inequity, that kind of disparity, all right, has got to be changed. You can do it. I don't believe that the Democratic Party is also free of their responsibility. I believe it has allowed the boundaries of national debate to move to the right, while millions of Americans who provide the base of support for the Democrats are moving in the other direction. But your participation in this more deeply can demonstrate that and can prove that. You can prove, as I believe we already have in the Democratic primary, I want you to hear this, that the people voting in the Democratic Party have essentially resisted and rejected the more conservative candidates. They have said, we don't want a conservative like Glenn. They have said, we don't want a more conservative like Hollings. They have chosen the three candidates that they regard to be the most liberal that was available in the field. And so, what I want you to do as a women's movement, and particularly those of you who regard yourselves as part of the women's political movement, is not to continue to underestimate our strength. That failing is a legacy of the past and of traditions that have taught women to speak softly, that is some of us, and carry a lipstick rather than to assert our needs and make demands. The time has come for us to increase our tactic. I know voting doesn't sound like a very exciting tactic, but I think with a big vote, with a vote of women which shows moving in across lines, that is, not every woman is in the gender gap, but it crosses lines of homemakers and working people. It crosses partisan lines. It crosses people of different age groups. It crosses people of different points of view. So that I believe our tactics, even as to what our vote can mean, have often been marked by timidity and self-deprecation. I mean, even now, in discussing possible women candidates for the vice presidency, most women leaders feel that only superwomen can be proposed as leaders of our country. They keep saying,